Very good.
Wow. I really like people from Indonesia and Singapore. They only give a few questions. Should be here when the Australians are on retreat. The basket is full of questions. We have to go all night. Very good. How can you hear better over here than on there? Very good. Very good. Can you hear okay? Very good. Excellent. Now the first question. What should I do if I try to keep noble silence, but people surrounded you keep talking and ask you questions? Is it too rude to ignore them? So what to do if you want to keep noble silence but other people don't and they're making a lot of noise? We have in Australia the one finger sign. You know how to give a person the one finger? No, not like that. This is one, yeah. That's the Buddhist one finger, not the other one. This one. So you don't have to actually to talk back to them. You just say, and that's the best answer you can possibly give somebody. So if anyone's making a noise, if they're talking loudly and they ask you a question, just go. But noble silence doesn't mean that you don't talk at all. Because we live here in Australia, not this time of the year, but the summertime. We have to be very careful of bushfires. And so I tell people if they come on retreat January, February, March or sometime like that, please don't keep noble silence if there's a fire. Don't go say, fire. For goodness sake, say it, fire. That is noble silence. Noble silence is speaking when it's really important. Stupidity is not speaking at all when there's a fire. Or it's snake, snake. If you see a snake, tell them, there's a snake. So otherwise it becomes stupid silence. Noble silence means you don't have to speak much at all, just a little bit. But certainly, I don't know why people are talking all the time. What do you need to talk about? So try and keep quiet. Otherwise, if you can't keep quiet on a retreat like this, you'll end up like the talkative tortoise. You remember that story? That is in my book, and that in from Indonesia. If you go to Wihara Mendut, I remember Venul Panyawara, he showed me, it's carved in the ancient Chanda there. The ancient monuments. Because what happened? There was a tortoise. And that tortoise couldn't stop speaking. He talked so much and so long that other people, the other animals, they just avoided him. Whenever they saw the talkative tortoise coming, they would hide. The rabbits would go down their holes. Their fishes would go under the rocks. The birds would fly up to the tallest trees because if they started having a conversation with talkative tortoise, he just would not stop. Once he started talking, he kept on talking, he wouldn't stop, he'd keep on going, going, going. No one knew how he could breathe, whether it was through his ears, because he wouldn't stop talking, even for a bell. He'd talk, 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 all the time, he'd never ever stop. He was a talkative tortoise, he'd talk about anything, anything stupid, he would keep on talking, talking, talking. Have you ever met anyone like that? Here on the retreat? Some people, they can't stop talking. And if you talk too much, it means you don't have any friends. You need to listen as well as talk. And sometimes the greatest friends are the ones who listen much and talk little. So poor talkative tortoise had no friends at all. He was so lonely. Except there were two swans who would come up to where the tortoise lived, up in the mountains, in the lake, during the summertime. Because it got so hot in Jakarta during the summertime. Do you have summertime? It's hot all the time, isn't it, in Jakarta? So hot in Hong Kong in the summertime. The swans would fly up the mountain where it was nice and cool, so they could have a nice holiday from the heat. And they'd stay up by that lake all summertime. And they were so kind. Such a big heart. They would always let the talkative tortoise to talk to them. And they would always listen. And that was the only friends the tortoise had. And when the two swans, they said, "It's time for us to fly back. It's getting cold up in the mountains." And the tortoise said, "Please don't go. I don't want you to go. Please stay around because I'll talk to somebody. Because if you're not here, I don't know who will ever talk to me. Because no one will ever listen to me because I talk too much." And the swan said, "Well, I'm afraid, you know, you can't fly. And if you walk, you're a tortoise. By the time it gets halfway, you'll have to come back again. You take so long." And the tortoise started to cry. "It's so lonely in here without you." And the swans, anyone who's very compassionate is also very wise. And they say, "We have a plan." "But," said the swans, "you have to promise one thing." And the tortoise said, I promise anything. I always keep my promise because I'm a tortoise and tortoises always keep their promises. They can do whatever they want because when they really make a promise, they will always keep that promise because we're good tortoises. It's in our blood. Tortoises always keep their promises and we're very good at keeping promises. So whatever it is you promise, I will promise it and I will keep it because I don't mind." And he went on like that for a long time. He said, "You have to keep your promise to keep your mouth shut." "It's very easy to keep my mouth shut," said the tortoise. "I hardly ever speak at all. My mouth is always shut and I always don't talk. I'm very good at keeping my mouth shut," said the tortoise. And so seriously, you have to keep your mouth shut. So the swans, they got a long stick. And one of the swans bit into one end of the stick. And the other one bit into the other end of the stick. And they told the tortoise to bite into the middle of the stick. And you can probably understand their plan. Swans started flapping their wings harder and harder and harder. And you know what happened? Nothing. The tortoise was too heavy. Because people who talk a lot tend to be fat. So they got a lighter stick. And they bit into the end. Tortoise bit into the middle. They flap harder and harder and harder and harder and harder and harder. Until the swans took off into the air. And with the swans went the stick. And with the stick went the tortoise. And that was the first time in history a tortoise had ever flown. And as it got higher and higher, its little lake got smaller and smaller. And the tortoise was remembering everything so he could tell his friends as soon as he got back. And everything was going very smoothly, flying over the mountains, over the foothills, until they got over to the plains of Hong Kong. And they don't have plains in Hong Kong, it's all hills, isn't it? But anyway, they got down to, you know, where all the towns and the villages and the cities. And they saw a school. And it was just the time the children come out of school. And one of the children happened to look up into the sky. And what did the child see? A flying tortoise. And he couldn't help himself. One of the kids turned around to his friend and said, "Hey, do you see that stupid tortoise flying?" Because that's how children speak. And the tortoise said, "Who you called him stupid? Oops." And the poor tortoise fell further and further down until it went splat on the street. And that's how the tortoise got killed, because it couldn't keep its mouth shut. So you have to train yourself. Noble silence. Who knows when you really need to keep your mouth shut? If you can't do it here, where can you do it? So if you talk too much, you too will end up like the talkative tortoise, hamburger patty on the streets of Hong Kong. That's the story I try and keep the kids quiet. The other story, which actually worked the other day, had two kids over in Crystal saw this happening. Little girl there. Two kids, they were talking so much in my temple in Perth on Friday night. I told them, I said, "Look, I will give you $20 from the donation box each if you can keep quiet to the count of 10, till I finish counting 10. And the kids said, yes, we'll do that, easy. So I started counting. And I have to keep my promises. You know, when I make a promise like that, I have to keep it. So I started doing it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And they were getting excited. They were halfway. 6, 7, 8. You can see the eyes get bigger. $20. 9. Then I started talking to their parents about Dhamma and meditation. And I never mentioned that number all night. So they both had to keep quiet until I finished my talk. And the mother was really pleased with me. Thank you so much, Ajahn Brahm. So be very, very careful. Don't talk too much. You don't have to. Maybe the first day you've got to find out where you are and what's going on. See if you can be quiet. Your meditation goes much more easily when you don't use your mouth. It's not that hard to do. So if someone talks to you, that's all you need to do. Give them the one finger. Next question. If I am not mistaken, there is a saying, sila develops samadhi, and meditation is samadhi. What is the best sila for us to create foundations and develop samadhi? Sila is your precepts. So the first precept is not to talk. And then it's so easy to meditate. So you keep the rules. Don't talk. Be kind. It's being kind to yourself. You talk so much. You know, if I hadn't told that story about old people talking so much, you'd think your mouth would wear out after all those talking. So, silence is golden. And one of the reasons why we don't talk is this great little saying from Lao Tzu. I'll never pronounce that right. I'm a Kwai Lo. I can't pronounce Chinese. But one of the founders of Taoism, he used to go on a walk with his disciples every evening. And there was one young man asked to go on a walk with the great master. And the master told him before the walk started, if you go on a walk with me, you have to keep the golden rule. You have to be quiet. You're not allowed to speak, not even one word, if you go on a walk with me. And so the student agreed. And they went on a walk together through the forest, through the mountains. And they came to a ridge in the mountains at sunset. And it was such a beautiful sunset. The student forgot the rule and said, wow, what a beautiful sunset. He'd broken the rules. And at that, the master turned around, went back to the temple. And as soon as he got back into the temple, he said, that young man can never, ever again go on a walk with me. And his friends of that young man said, oh, give him a break, give him a chance. He made a mistake. We all make a mistake sometimes. Anyway, what's wrong with speaking? And that's when the teacher said the meaning of silence. When my student said, what a beautiful sunset, he wasn't watching the sunset anymore. He was only watching the words. Because when you speak, you're mindful of the words. You're not mindful of the thing that you are trying to describe. Whenever you say, what a beautiful sunset, you're not watching the sunset. You're just watching the words. And which is closest to reality? Which is closest to truth? The words or the experience? The experiences. So if you want to become enlightened, if you want to see the truth, don't say anything. And then you can hear the truth. If you're speaking, how on earth can you listen? So don't use your mouth. Use your ears. Use your mindfulness. And then you will find the truth. That seeing the beautiful sunset is so much different than saying, what a beautiful sunset. All wisdom comes from silence, not from words. So that's why we try and keep quiet. Now, the sila is just being kind to yourself, being a good person. And that takes a lot of effort sometimes. It takes restraint. It takes letting go of what I want to do and instead doing what's good for me. And if you can't restrain your body and speech that much, how on earth are you going to train your mind? So first of all, we train our body. We train our speech. So if you are going to say anything, only say kind things. Never criticize a person. Never say bad things to a person. If you speak bad things to another person, in your next life, you'll be reborn as a crow. Gah, gah, gah! Which makes terrible sounds here in Australia. So be careful if you tell other people off. If you shout at them. If you're angry at them, you say terrible words which sound awful. In your next life, you'll be a bird who makes an awful sound. So always speak kind words. So that's number one. And number two, always do kind things. Don't be mean and nasty. So it's very hard for you to break any precepts in this place. There's nothing to kill. We don't have mosquitoes. So you don't have to swat anything. And what else don't we have here? Obviously, you don't need to kill each other. That's not. Even if, like, sometimes you feel like doing that, because somebody always bangs the door. You know, in every cottage there's always somebody who likes to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and bang the door and turn on the kettle and make a lot of noise just when you're going to sleep. So, I should tell you to please, when you go into your room at night, when you open the door, when you close the door, even if you want some water in the central little room there, you've got to imagine that you are a burglar. Because burglars, they can enter a room and no one hears them. They can actually go in into your bedroom and take something and you don't hear them. And they're bad people. You're good people. You don't even go into somebody else's room. You go into your room, bang, crash. Everybody hears you. So if burglars can be quiet, surely you can. So see if whenever you go into your room, into your cottage, or even if you come in here, pretend you're a burglar. You step so softly. You open the doors. There's not even a creak. You close them. There's not a bang. You enter silently. You leave without any noise. Then, at the very least, if you don't get good meditation here, at least you've got a career when you go when you go back home. No, I'm not recommending that career. But if burglars can do that, why can't you? So you just need to be a bit more careful. And that is part of your precept. If you do that, you have to be mindful. You're thinking of other people. You're not just thinking of yourself, which is, you know, part of the precepts there. So that's why if you do keep these precepts, if you care about other people, not just yourself, and you're mindful to keep quiet, not make so much noise, looking after one another, that is your precepts. And you find it so easy to get into nice meditation. Number one, you don't have any guilt about what you've done in the last couple of days. You're not sort of, don't have so many desires of what you want. You have enough food here. Is there enough food? Only a few people said yes. It's good enough. You're not starving. Maybe a little bit hungry in the evening, but, you know, that's being arranged. So don't have to worry about these things. So if you're a good, kind person, it means when you start meditating, the mind is already very peaceful. Have you noticed just when you do bad things how it really worries your mind? And you can't be peaceful because you've got guilt. So when you're a good person, you have no guilt, no remorse, no worries at all. It's just like sometimes the police come to a monastery. When they come to the monastery, I'm not scared. Some of the lay people are staying here, they disappear. But me, because I've done nothing wrong. I'm a good monk, there's nothing which I've ever done. So they usually come in to ask me to come and give a talk somewhere, or, you know, is there something going on? Or the last time they came, because somebody made me an executor of their will and they died, so the police had to come and let me know they died. It's all good stuff. But if the police came to your house, would you be scared? Even if I get accused of something I didn't do, I'm not scared. Because if I went to prison, you know, for something I didn't do, that would be even better than being a monk. I wouldn't have to give any talks. I wouldn't have to go and teach. I wouldn't have to answer any questions. I have my own cell, which is probably more comfortable than my cave. You seen my cave? You know, in a prison cell, you get a proper bed, you know, not on the floor like I sleep on. You get a TV, you get your own kettle, you can exercise, you get 3 meals a day instead of 2, and you get much more choice. Better choice in prison than you get in our monastery. So if I ever go to jail, I quite look forward to it. And if I ever want to have a retreat, just punch a prison officer on the nose, they put me in solitary for 3 months. Brilliant! 3 months of meditation in solitary. So I'm not afraid of going to jail, I'm not afraid of police, because I'm a good monk. So wherever you go, you'll always be looked after. That's what happens when you have precepts. No worries at all. You know, even when I go traveling, you know, I go to Indonesia, Hong Kong, I don't have any travel insurance. No travel insurance at all. You know why? Because if I fell over and broke my leg in Hong Kong, there'll be so many people fighting to pay my hospital bills. No, me. I want to make the good karma. No, no, me. You had it last time. No, me. Same in Indonesia. Sometimes if I have a cough, then in 1 hour's time I have all this medicine in front of me. That's my insurance. Because you've been a good monk, you've cared, you've given, I have nothing to worry about. That is the result of having sila, being kind, being giving, being compassionate. That is my insurance policy. So I can go anywhere in the world. No, I'm always going to get looked after. Isn't that nice? Isn't that wonderful? Now that's the benefit of sila, of precepts, of being compassionate, being good, not harming other people. It means other people will always look after you. So that means you're so free of worries and concern, which means you can be very light, which means the meditation can really get very, 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 very deep. So, be kind, be generous, look after one another, and then you have no worries in the world, no bad feelings of the past. When you look at what you've done the last week, it's only been good things, which makes you happy. When you look at what's going to happen in the future, you're just going to keep on doing good, kind, generous things. Which is a wonderful way of looking at the future. Which means no worries about the future, no worries about the past. It's easy to let it go when you're good. So I always say, if you want a good time, be a good person. I am a good time monk. Having a good time. When does an everyday activity, e.g. eating, shopping, travelling become sensual pleasure? Shopping's not an everyday activity for a monk. Why do you go shopping? I still can't figure this out. Australians go to Hong Kong to do shopping. People from Hong Kong come to Australia to do shopping. Same with Indonesia. You want to go shop? It's the same shops. The same stuff. If you go to buy something in the shops in Perth, you'll probably find out made in Hong Kong. Or made in Indonesia. Why do you go shopping for? Haven't you got enough stuff? Have you got enough stuff? Would you like to go shopping? Shall we organise a shopping trip? Hands up if you'd like to go shopping on the last day. Now be honest, you're all lying, breaking your precepts. No, it's nice not to go shopping. You know, shopping centres are just so awful to be in. There used to be, before the internet, whenever I had to go and get a flight, was actually going in the shopping centre where the travel agent was. I used to hate that. Shopping centres, just such harsh sensory input. All those colours and the sounds and the smells trying to get you to buy something. You don't need to buy things. Actually, I told that story. Okay, here we go. Bad joke coming up. You know the bad joke about the supermarket? This is gross, but it's funny. An old lady went into the supermarket to buy some stuff. And at the checkout counter, in her tray, on a basket, was some dog food. And the little girl at the checkout counter said, "Madam, have you got a dog?" She said, "Of course I've got a dog. What's the dog food is here for?" "Madam, in harsh economic times, sometimes old people, they have to eat dog food. They can't afford real food. And it's our supermarket policy. We won't let old people do that. So you have to bring your dog in so we know you have a dog. Then we can let you have the dog food." Fortunately, she just lived very close. So she went back home, bought a nice little dog in, and they sort of ticked her name down. "Okay, madam, from now on, you can always have dog food, because we know it's for your dog, not for you." The next day, she went into the same supermarket, and in her basket was cat food. And they said, "Madam, we can't let you take this home until we make sure that you've got a cat." "But I don't have to bring the cat in as well, do I?" said the old woman, getting a bit upset. "Yes, company policy." "Okay," she moaned. And she went home and brought her nice little cat back. She said, "Okay, I've got a cat, okay? Now can I have cat food?" She said, "Oh yes, madam, please. We have to look after our elderly people." So the next day she was back in the supermarket, at the same checkout counter, the same person, and she had a shoebox with a hole in it. And she said, "Madam, could you..." Now this was the old lady said to the checkout girl, "Can you put your hand in here, please?" And the checkout girl put her hand in there, in the box. And it was all brown and yucky and sticky and smelly. She said, "Well, you made me touch!" And the old lady said, "Now can I please have some toilet paper?" And the moral of that story is don't mess with old women. So that's my shopping story. So where does it become sensual pleasures? It is when you shop for things you don't need. Then it's sensory pleasures. What are you doing it for? It's not necessary. When you speak when it's not necessary. When you travel when it's not necessary. When you eat when it's not necessary. Then it's sensual pleasures. So if it really is necessary, then fine. Off you go do some shopping. Or if you have to eat, then if it's necessary, eat. If you have to travel somewhere, then travel. But if it's not necessary, why don't you stay at home? Where is the most comfortable bed in the whole world? At your home. How much money do you have to spend for your house, your apartment? Really expensive. And the first time you have a holiday, you leave it and go somewhere else. Why don't you stay in your home? They say there's no place like home. There is no hotel. There is no food like your home-cooked food. Even though we try our very best here, it's not the same as cooking it in your own home. So why do you travel so much? So the next time you have a holiday, spend it at home. Or at Jardin Grove, either. Jardin Grove, okay. That's not sensory pleasures. But I don't know why people go traveling around the world. They want to go and see the Great Wall of China. Have you seen the Great Wall of China yet? I haven't seen the Great Wall of China. If you want to see the Great Wall of China, go to Bodhinyana Monastery. There's a wall there. Fancy. It's a wall, bricks. What's the difference? If you want to see Niagara Falls, go into your shower and turn on the water. That's falling water, it's the same. What's the difference? I can't understand why people want to go travelling. They see this and they see that. You don't need to. If you, yeah, just these days, just go on the internet. See whatever you like. Don't have to travel at all. You can even get your photograph taken and Photoshop with Niagara Falls. Send it to your friends. Here's me in Niagara Falls. So you don't need to go anywhere. Why do you have to go to places like that? Sometimes I really wonder why people go traveling to see all these things. Sometimes, you know, the last time I was about 1 year, 2 years ago, I went to Las Vegas. Straight away you're thinking, what are you going to Las Vegas for, Ajahn Brahm? Trying to raise funds for your monastery? I found out how I could do that. Actually, this was the last time I was in Hong Kong. They took me to Macau. Not the last time, the time before. And we figured out a way to raise funds for our nuns' monastery. And a good way, you know, and not in a sort of a bad, illegal, unmonkish way. I was going to sit outside the casino, just sit there, that's all. Not even ask for any money, just sit. Because in Hong Kong, it's bad luck to see a monk as you go to bed. So I just sit outside, and all the patrons, they see me sitting outside, and they go to the casino next door. And so the clients, the profits would go down, and I wouldn't move until the owners of the casino gave a substantial donation to the monastery, because I was bad for their business sitting outside. If they gave a good check donation, then I'd move to the casino next door and keep going like that. I thought that was a good way of raising funds, and it wouldn't be a bad way, because I was actually stopping people gambling. Would that be keeping my precepts, doing it that way? Maybe not. I didn't do it anyway. So I don't know why people, why do you go gambling for? Do you like going gambling? Is that exciting? Because I know people in Hong Kong, they love gambling. Gambling on horses, gambling on machines, gambling on a roulette table. And sometimes they think they can beat the odds. You cannot beat the odds. The odds always beat you. But sometimes people go to the temple or they ask a monk. They want supernatural help. And it reminds me of the story. This man here in Perth, he was just reading a book one day and he heard someone tell him, go to the casino. Go to the casino. And he looked around, there's no one in his bedroom at all. There's no one there. So I was just imagining it. So he carried on reading his book. And it was like someone speaking right behind him. Go to the casino. Go to the casino. He heard it very clearly. And he thought maybe some heavenly being was helping him. So he got dressed, took some money, and went to the casino. And as soon as he walked into the casino door, he heard the voice again, really clear, and there's no one else around. Go to the roulette table. Go to the roulette table. So he went to the roulette table and he sat down and he heard the voice again. Put $10 on number 17. Put $10 on number 17. He could hear that, no one else could. So he got a $10 chip, put it on number 17. And the croupier, the guy who works for the casino, threw the ball in the wheel, span the wheel, went round and round and round, and guess which number it landed in? 17. And he could hear the voice say, yeah, yeah. And then the voice said, put all the winnings on number 32. All the winnings on number 32. So he put all the chips on number 32. And the croupier spanned the wheel, threw the ball in, went round and round and round, and where did it land? 32! And he could hear the supernatural voice says, woohoo, woohoo! Put all the winnings on number 6. put all the winnings on number 6. He'd already made a lot of money. If this came up, he'd be a millionaire. And everybody could see this run of good luck, and they were all looking. And even the creepy said, "Are you sure, sir?" "Yes," because he had the divine voice. So he put all the winnings on number 6. And the croupier spanned the wheel, threw the ball in, and everyone went silent as the ball went round and round. And this man could hardly believe. This was going to be his fortune. And it was the divine voice, went round and round and round. And as it stopped, it fell in number 6 and bounced out into number 7. And he heard the divine voice said, "Oh shit." Oh shit. Even the divine voice makes mistakes. So don't believe even divine voices. Even angels don't get it right sometimes and make you lose all your money. So that's sensory pleasures. So no need to go eating, shopping, travelling or gambling. You always lose. How come all these casinos are so rich? How come the people, you know, run the Happy Valley get so rich? Because all the stupid people are betting on the horses. Dear Jambram, I have heard that people sometimes get enlightened when they die. How do you know that? Do they come back and tell you? Because if they get enlightened, they can't come back again. So you don't know this stuff. Gee. I heard that people get enlightened when they die, but I'm curious about how this happens. Do they need to have attained jhana near their death so their mind stays still? Also, if they see the bright light and are drawn towards it, won't they end up in a high Brahma realm for eons rather than becoming enlightened? Could you elucidate about the process of possible enlightenment at death? Thank you. When you die, you have to let go. You've got no choice. Right here, it's very hard to get you to let go. Remember, when you die, you can't take a bag of noodles with you up into heaven. Your stuff. You can't take anything with you. So you have to let go. You have to let go of all of your friends and your enemies as well. Everyone you have to let go of. And you have to let go of your body, whether it's young and beautiful or old and ugly. Everything has to be let go of. That is why it's such an amazing experience. So actually you have to let go. So you do let go. And it's just like in the meditation, these nimittas, which I talk about and we'll talk about more in the next couple of days. These lights come up in meditation when your 5 senses get so still. They've disappeared or almost disappeared. And that's like when you die, your 5 senses have actually stopped. You're dead. You can't see, you can't hear, you can't smell, you can't taste, you can't touch anymore. You're dead. And the 6th sense, the mind sense, that continues on. And that's why people with near-death experiences, they go towards the light. It's exactly the same you see when you're meditating. But when you're meditating, you know, you don't die. You come back again, no problem at all. So this is actually like practicing. Practicing how to die. You know, when you get married, you go to marriage lessons, you become an accountant, you have to do all this training first of all. You know, if you become a professor, you have to do lots and lots of studies. Everything in life you have to train for, except for dying. And that's the one thing we all have to do. So wouldn't it be a good idea to have dying classes? Teaching people how to die, because we're all going to do it sooner or later. You can start a good business in Hong Kong or Singapore. How to die. And actually what I'm teaching you here, how to let go and how to go towards the light. And sometimes people say, "Well, look, if I go towards that light, I'll be stuck and I'm in these jhana realms for eons." If you are a stream winner, you've already seen enough about the Dharma to know there's nobody in here, and you go to those jhana realms, then when those jhana realms fade away, so do you. They call that a jhana anagami. It's like another way of exiting samsara. That's your last life in the jhana realms. Blissing out for eons. And when that finishes, Nibbana. Great way to go. Called Jhana Anagami. An Anagami based on the jhanas. So it's not as if you have to bliss out and get reborn as a worm afterwards. That will never happen. You just have a beautiful high state. If the jhana realm ends, at the very least you'll probably be a deva or a very, very refined human being. So it's not wasting time. It's a great way of going. So, that can be what happens. But remember, even now when some of you have got these lights in the mind, you can't maintain them because you keep doing stuff with them. They can't solidify and stay. And if you can't do that when you're alive, when you die you'll be messing around with this nimitta, this light you see, afraid of it, excited about it. You won't be able to develop it. So when you learn about how to deal with the nimitta now when you're alive, then you'll be very good when you die. So this is How to Die Retreat. Very good. Next question. You emphasize that we are already good enough. And we're going to accept our imperfections. In fact, I don't quite understand. If I'm a selfish, jealous and demanding person, am I supposed to improve myself so as to be a better person who is free from these bad qualities? If I think I'm already good enough, am I not supposed to make any improvements on my shortcomings? Now, this is an interesting question. Have you ever noticed when people try to improve themselves, they usually get worse? They get more jealous. That's what happens on some retreats. On some retreats, when we really emphasize attainments, and then someone comes along and says, I've just got jhanas. And you look at them and say, you? You've just come on this retreat first time. This is my 10th retreat. I haven't got jhanas yet. That's really unfair. It's amazing how much jealousy comes up when we start speaking about attainments. So if you try to improve yourself, you are measuring yourself. And when you measure yourself, you'll be measuring other people as well. You'll even be measuring me and the monks. Which of the monks is the most enlightened? It's not the one who always speaks. It's the ones who are silent who are the wisest. The Buddha said, it is the great rivers flow silently. It is the small streams which make all the noise. So what am I? So look at these great silent rivers. They are the ones who should be giving the talk, not me. How can you measure who's enlightened and who isn't? How can you measure that? Sometimes we can't. So when you start measuring, that's when you start getting jealousy. And you start getting even anger as well. And greed by measuring. So that's why I say, don't look at these things as imperfections. Accept yourself for who you are. Open the door of your heart to yourself. Be at peace with yourself. And then, all the imperfections vanish. They all come from measuring. And when we stop measuring people, when we stop measuring ourselves, that is called the end of conceit. The Buddha taught three conceits. I am better than other people. I am worse than other people. And I am the same as other people. The Buddha said all three of those are wrong view. It's delusion. That is why when you understand the Dharma, you're not better than others. You're not worse. You're not the same. There's no one there to compare with. That is why there's a very wonderful little sutra where the monk comes up to see the Buddha and he tells the Buddha, one who is an arahat, perfectly enlightened, never thinks they are better than anybody else. Nor worse than anybody else, nor the same as anybody else. The Buddha said, yes, correct. And another monk comes up and says the same thing. One who is enlightened never thinks they're better, they're worse, or the same. Very good, said the Buddha. When that second monk left, the Buddha turned around to Ananda, his attendant, and said, "Those were two arahats. That's how they come and let me know they've attained to being enlightened." Not better, not worse, not the same. And that's you. So what's there to improve? If you try to improve, your jealousy, your anger, your craving will get worse. When you let things be, then that all vanishes and disappears. So if you want to get enlightened, you better accept yourself as you are. You'll be stuck with yourself for a while yet, so you better get to like yourself. This whole thing about self-improvement. Self-improvement. There's no self there. So who the heck are you trying to improve? If you can answer that question, then you'll be an arahat. Who are you trying to improve? What does Buddhism understand in grieving? When a loved one dies, how do those left behind handle grief? From the Buddhist teachings. When a loved one passes away, we look at them in my simile of a concert. They're dead. They've gone. What a wonderful time we've had together. Because my simile of the concert, I used to go to so many concerts when I was young. We're just talking at the tea time in Bodhinyana this afternoon. I went to see the Rolling Stones when I was only 11 years of age. Where that came up, we had a novice ordained Thursday, so we had to give him a name. That was Rob. And we gave him the name Chaga. That Chaga means like giving. And so he's now got the nickname Mick Jagger for the Rolling Stones. He's always getting nicknamed for something or other. So you know, Rob is now Mick Jagger. Jagger. So anyway. So that got me into thinking of the Rolling Stones when I was young. And I saw them when I was 11 years of age. And one of the first time I began to hate women. Maybe one of the reasons why I eventually became a monk. Because I went there to listen to the music. And you girls were screaming and screaming your head off, and I couldn't hear anything. I could hear this screaming of girls, really stupid. And I went in there, listen to the music. And so I hated you girls from that time. It took me a long time to go out with a girl after that. But I used to go to all these lovely concerts in London. I like telling the story. With my brother, I went to this room above a pub in the north of London. And there was a band playing there. And only six people turned up to watch. My brother and I were two of those six. And now, because there's only such a small crowd, only six people, I thought the band would take one look, only six people, and go home. What's the point of playing for just six? But they played everything for us. It was like a private concert. And the lead singer was called Rod Stewart. A private concert with Rod. So I had lots of experiences like that. I saw the first concert of Led Zeppelin. Whoa, yeah. If anyone else likes rock music, we had one of the great concerts was an all-night concert for those who like rock music. 2 hours of the Doors, 2 hours of they're called Jefferson Airplane. Another 2 hours of the Doors, another 2 hours of Jefferson. All night, 8 hours of, you know, the best rock bands from the US. Wow. I remember those, but I also remember when the band was about to finish. Sometimes went to orchestras in the Royal Albert Hall. When the orchestra or band was about to finish, we'd all stand up, clap our hands and shout for the encore. And they would play another 5 minutes. But they couldn't play that long. They had to go home. So did we. And as soon as the music was over, and I knew, you know, the chances are I was wise enough, I wouldn't hear such great music again like that. When I walked out of the concert halls, pubs, clubs of London, never once did I have grief that the concert was over. I never cried at the end of a great performance. In fact, I felt just so privileged, so lucky to have been there and witnessed some of the greatest music in the world. And I knew I'd never forget that. And I haven't forgotten it, even now. It's over 40 years ago, and I can still picture that. Just like when my father died. By his bedside, wanting an encore, he gave a few more days, but when he died, I never felt sad. What a great performance, like one of the best concerts, and how lucky I was there, I was, to have been there at the time. For all the 16 years I knew my dad, thank you so much. That is how we look at death. The end of a great concert. Thank you so much for being my father, my mother, my wife. It's been such a wonderful time. I wouldn't have missed that for the world. Not grief, this beautiful feeling of gratitude. The same feeling at the end of a wonderful concert. That's how we deal with death in Buddhism. Can you recommend some books on the original text about the Buddha's original teachings? Thank you. Yeah, there's some very good translations now of the Buddha's original teachings. But what are the Buddha's original teachings? Is it Theravada? Some of you are nodding. No, it is not. Theravada has added stuff. Mahayana has added stuff. Vajrayana has added stuff. Everybody adds stuff. Even when I tell stories, I always add stuff. So, how do we know what's the original teachings? And if you aren't very interesting, Ajahn Brahmali here, together with Ajahn Sujata, with a bit of support from a few others, did this authenticity project to empower people to find out for yourself what the original teachings are, combining some of the Chinese agamas and the Pali canon to find out what was original. And if you go to that, there's some parts which you thought were original, but they're not. Number one, Abhidhamma. That was way after the time of the Buddha. Oh, what a relief. You don't have to study that to become enlightened. When I saw that, I thought, oh, thank goodness for that. Because it was so complicated. And all these little things. You don't have to do that. In the time of the Buddha, you just give one simple teaching and all these people are getting enlightened. So it gets too complicated. And it's not in the original teachings. It's very clear. It's a very logical argument. And a lot of times people say Buddhism is good because it's come and see, figure it out for yourself. It's supposed to be evidence-based. And the evidence is there. Buddha never taught the Abhidhamma. And there's some other things he didn't teach as well. Vipassana. Did the Buddha ever teach Vipassana meditation? Look in the suttas. You won't find that anywhere. Did the Buddha teach Samatha meditation? No. The Buddha taught Eightfold Path. Keep it simple, straight. Because these days people always want shortcut. They want Vipassana shortcut. Or Jhana shortcut. Or chanting shortcut. Just do some chanting and then you become enlightened. We all want shortcuts. There ain't no shortcut. How many times have you taken a shortcut and got lost? Was it last year or a couple of years ago, had some Singaporeans. They took a shortcut and they got lost in the forest. They went to a house, they were totally lost, it was getting dark. It was only not that far away. And the neighbours sort of drove them back here. So don't take shortcuts. So Eightfold Path, Eightfold Path, Eightfold Path. That's the only way to become enlightened. So keep it simple. And that is basic Buddhism. And that is original teachings. All this other stuff, when they try and make it shortcut, sorry, no way. So if you want to find some original books, get on the internet. You can get the original teachings in Chinese or in sort of Bahasa. I'm sure that's in English now. Some really good translations. Original teachings of the Buddha. Even now, you know, even Ajahn Chah, I was with Ajahn Chah for years. And now, you know, some of the teachings I read about Ajahn Chah, he never said that. I was there, I lived with him. Ajahn Chah, even Ajahn Chah's teachings are now getting added to. So even in their own, just a few years after they die, we always add and interpret and say things he never ever said. So I'm sure that my teaching soon, what are the original Ajahn Brahm teachings? You're going to add stuff, because that's what really happens. Anyway, last question. Dear Ajahn, can one attain enlightenment by walking meditation? Many thanks. Many people did become enlightened through walking meditation after they had practiced the Eightfold Path. You can't just think walking meditation is enough. Sometimes people ask me, can you get jhanas by doing walking meditation? And I always thought it was impossible. You can't get jhanas by walking meditation. But apparently, I was wrong. Because there's one monk in Thailand who does get jhanas by doing walking meditation. And we can tell because he's got all bruises and cuts over his head. Because if you get into jhana, you lose all awareness of your body. You're in the mind, you're blissed out, you don't know what the body's doing. So if you get into jhanas on a walking meditation here, you hit the wall. You go bang. And you won't know anything about it. So if you are going to do jhanas and do walking meditation, like someone's already done, walk around the stupa. Because when you get into jhana, you keep walking, 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 walking all night, all the next day. At least you won't, fall off or hit a tree or something. You just go round and round and round and round and round. That's why sometimes if you want to do walking meditation in Indonesia or Hong Kong, it's so hard to find a place to do walking meditation, is it? No, it's very easy. Get one of these treadmills, like in the, in the exercise places. And you can just, do walking meditation in your apartment. You get a nice picture, of like Bodhinyana Monastery or something, or Jhana Grove. And then you go a little way and then you turn around and go back again. So you can do it on a treadmill. So you don't need these big places. Is that a good idea? And if it's on a treadmill, then you can get into a jhana and then it doesn't really matter because you're not really going anywhere. So you don't bump into things. Or even better, get one of these, I don't know if you ever had like pet mice when you were young, they get one of these little wheels. And you can do walking meditation at home and at the same time you can have a little generator to actually to power, so it's like green walking meditation. to not waste your energy. And that would be very sustainable and very good Buddhist statement that you really care for the environment. So do walking meditation in your apartment at the same time, power all the stuff which runs your lights and refrigerator at the same time. Wouldn't that be a good idea? I've got all these great ideas for business because Buddhism is becoming much more popular these days. And with the popularity of Buddhism, especially in the West, and especially with meditation, there's all these opportunities for you for making new business. Meditation cushions. Just these little cushions over here. This is old-fashioned. Can't we do better than this? Can't we have high-tech meditation cushion? With a little console at the side. So you can actually, little portions of the cushion, you can actually inflate it to get it sort of a little bit higher. This side higher, that side higher. I just went to Korea and they have one of these Japanese toilets where it's actually warm the seat up. You've been to see one of those toilets? And you can press the button, you get nice hot water, and it goes exactly in the right place. Why don't we spend so much time in the toilet? That's excellent. Meditators, Buddhists spend so much time on meditation cushions. Is this the best we can do? Imagine you can actually press a button, you can adjust your back this way, adjust your back that way. Now if you're too cold, because you come from sort of Indonesia, you can have it warmed up for you. If you're a Kuai Lo, you can cool it down. And you can even have another little button in case you have sloth and torpor. And gives you a cup of coffee, espresso or cappuccino, whatever you want. Just to press the button. So you can have another little hole in the, if you want to go to the toilet. You're just about to go to jhana. It can actually get that out for you at the same time. So you don't have to mess up your meditation because of toilets. You can actually do it right there. There's so many things you can do for a state-of-the-art meditation cushion. The business opportunities are immense. So I got the ideas. So I just need the capital and the innovation for high-tech meditation cushions. Brilliant. You can even have another one you can put in an iPod, and like a jack or something, so you get all the talks on there. You don't have to get up to actually to get the nice talks going on. And even actually, you know, because I know that people these days, another one so you can check your email without getting up from your seat. So anyway, Wi-Fi enabled meditation cushions. Waiting. A market opportunity for someone. Okay, enough messing around. So that, thank you for those questions, but I don't know if I answered them at all. Enlightenment by walking meditation, many thanks. Yeah, you get lots of insight. You get enlightenment by eightfold path. Walking meditation is part of it. Keeping precepts is part of it. Learning Dhamma is part of it. The whole eightfold path needs to be done. And if you do the eightfold path, this is actually serious. This always really gets to me. The Buddha said, anyone who practices the eightfold path will become a spring winner, or a once returner, or a non-returner, or an arahant. So just what happens? You put the causes in place, these things will have to happen. So if you follow eightfold path, you can expect these things will happen. If they don't happen, it means you haven't understood the eightfold path, you haven't been practicing it. That's the only reason why not. The eightfold path leads to nirvana. If you walk it, it's going to happen. Guaranteed by the Buddha. So can you practice the Eightfold Path? Then you can become enlightened. Now you know what to do. It's inspiring, but it's also so true. That's something to go to bed with. Good night.